Jesus spent his last night as a human in the company of his disciples, as we know from the account, observing the Passover and giving his parting thoughts and instructions to them, although they did not know it was his last night with them. He had washed his disciples' feet to impress upon them the lessons of humility and service to one another, lessons that he had previously tried to communicate with words. Now he was trying to teach these lessons through his actions. He also told them many things that he wanted them to remember. These were the last hours that Jesus would be together with his disciples, and he told them the most important things he wanted them to remember. Jesus said that one of them would betray him, and there was disbelief among them. He said that it would be the one to whom he gives a piece of bread dipped in the dish of wine, broth, or sauce. He then dipped a piece of bread and gave it to Judas. Judas got up and left, and then Jesus said, and this is in John 13:33, "My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come." And it was after this that Jesus gave some of his deeper lessons. The very first one was a new commandment. That's what he called it. And we read this in the next verses, John 13:34 and 35. If you're following along, I'm usually reading from the New International Version. "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." A while later, still talking with his disciples, he repeated this. This is in John 15:12-14. "My command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command." Well, how was loving one another a new commandment? Wasn't loving one another already taught by God through the law and the prophets in the Old Testament? Well, let's see. If we go back to Leviticus, the 19th chapter, we're going to read verses 16-18. Leviticus 19:16-18. "Do not go about spreading slander among your people. Do not do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. I am the Lord. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Rebuke your neighbor frankly so you will not share in his guilt. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against one of your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." So we kind of had that commandment already from the Old Testament. But by the time of Jesus, and actually long before, this commandment had become corrupted. Here is what he said during his Sermon on the Mount. This is Matthew 5:43-48. "You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." Now, maybe this corruption of love your neighbor and hate your enemy had been rationalized as justified because of scriptures such as Deuteronomy 23. I'm going to read just verse 6. It says, as long as you are a nation, never do anything to help these nations or to make them prosperous. And he had referenced several groups of people before in the previous verses. Never do anything to help these nations. Well, that might have been a rationale. Or in Psalm 139, a Psalm of David, verses 19 to 24, it says, if only you would slay the wicked, O God, away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. So maybe the Jews got the idea from that kind of a passage. I have nothing but hatred for them. Well, we also know that love your neighbor as yourself was part of the Old Testament law by the answer that an expert in the law, a scribe or a Pharisee, gave to Jesus as recorded in Luke 10. It says in verses 25 to 29, on one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he said, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law? Jesus replied. How do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus replied, you have answered correctly. Do this and you will live. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Well, we know that Jesus went on to give a parable in answer to that question. It was the parable that we know as the parable of the Good Samaritan. And at the end of that parable, Jesus said, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? And that expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. Jesus told him, go and do likewise. By this parable, Jesus explains that anyone in need should be treated as if they are our neighbor. So isn't love thy neighbor as thyself the same as Jesus' new command to love one another? What was new about this? Well, let's read it again. John 13:34 and 35. A new command I give you. Love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. What is new about this command is this phrase, as I have loved you. What is new is that Jesus was saying that his disciples must not simply love their neighbors as themselves, but to love their neighbors more than themselves. And Jesus was going to demonstrate this later that night and the next day. Just as he had resorted to teaching by his actions when he washed their feet, demonstrating the lessons of humility and service, he was now going to demonstrate that he loved others more than himself, more than his own life, by dying to redeem and save them. Now, elsewhere, Jesus had said, and this is in Luke 6, verses 32 to 36, if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, because He is kind to the ungrateful and wicked. Be merciful, just as your Heavenly Father is merciful. That is a higher standard of love than had been taught before. Jesus was laying the foundation for His new commandment. He stated the same in His Sermon on the Mount, which we already read. But as we said in a discourse last year, sometimes we can imagine that there are limits to the love of Jesus, and that there are limits to God's love. But each sacrifice which was most precious to them, to save and redeem a completely rebellious human race. The Apostle Paul writes that the extent of the love of Jesus is beyond our comprehension. This is in Ephesians 3, verses 16 to 19. I pray that out of His glorious riches He may strengthen you with power through His Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power, together with all the saints, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. Paul is saying that Christ's love was so great that he willingly gave His life in a very painful and humiliating way, being crucified on a cross. Here's what Paul says about Him in Hebrews 2:12-3. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before Him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider Him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. The joy that Jesus had over what He was accomplishing enabled Him to endure the pain and humiliation of the cross. As Paul said in Ephesians, the love of Christ is beyond knowing. It's beyond our comprehension. It is that high and wide and deep and long. Is our love so great that we would gladly give our life to save humanity? Do we love our neighbors more than ourselves? Jesus did. Besides the testimony of the standard of love demonstrated by Jesus, there are also a couple of contemporary stories of this kind of love. There is the true story of Desmond Doss. His story was related in the 2016 movie entitled Hacksaw Ridge. Some of you may have seen it. He was a very religious Seventh-day Adventist Christian, and because of that church's teachings on nonviolence, and because of events in his childhood and youth, Desmond never wanted anything to do with guns. But in World War II, he enlisted with the intent of becoming a medic to help save lives. The Army sent him to basic training to teach him to be a combat soldier. He refused to handle guns and pleaded to be trained as a medic. He was mistreated by Army training officers and his fellow recruits. But eventually, he was allowed to be trained as a medic. At the Battle of Okinawa, his division was assigned to take control of a high escarpment, which they named Hacksaw Ridge, where the Japanese were well entrenched. After ascending the escarpment by climbing up rope nets, they came under heavy fire. Many were killed and wounded, forcing the Americans to retreat off the escarpment. at great peril to himself. Desmond remained on the ridge all night, all by himself, moving around stealthily, finding wounded soldiers, treating their wounds, carrying or dragging them to the escarpment edge, and lowering each one with a rope down to American soldiers below. He said that each time he lowered one and pulled the rope back up, he prayed, "Lord, help me to find one more." He kept doing this all night long, and he saved the lives of 75 wounded men. Desmond Doss loved others more than his own life. In 1974, I went on a trip to Europe, Egypt, and Israel, organized by Brother Carl Hagensick. We attended a convention in Lille, France, and then headed to Krakow, Poland, to attend 2 days of the Polish General Convention. But Carl had the dates wrong, and we arrived the day before the convention began. Well, we wondered, what will we do with this extra day? Options were quickly organized, and about half of us visited Auschwitz concentration camp. Because we had not made any prior arrangement to go there, there were no English-speaking guides available, only Polish. But we had Polish-speaking brethren. So, Sister Florence Niemiecki translated the guide's messages into English for us during our visit. During the course of the visit, the guide told us that only a few people ever escaped from Auschwitz. Whenever one did, the camp guards would execute 10 prisoners, either by hanging, firing squad at the wall of death, or by putting them in a chamber of death, a room in the basement of a building next to the wall of death that could be sealed airtight. Once men were locked in there, the guards would close off the air vents, and the men would eventually suffocate. While standing outside that building, the guide showed us a plaque honoring a Polish Catholic priest that had been mounted to the wall of that building. He then told us the story that there was only one time that more than a single person escaped from Auschwitz, a time when 3 people escaped Auschwitz together. The guards therefore selected 30 people, 10 for each escapee, and began herding them into the chamber of death. One of the 30 men, a local farmer who was in the camp, imprisoned in the camp, collapsed on the ground in tears and begged the guards not to kill him. The Polish Catholic priest, who had not been selected and was still standing in formation, was moved with compassion. He walked up to the guards and asked if he could take the man's place. The guards freed the crying man, and the priest walked into the chamber of death and died. The farmer survived until the end of the war and was released from the camp. After the war, he had the plaque made to honor the priest who had given his life so that he could live. The Polish Catholic priest loved his neighbor more than himself. Brother Carl was with us that day at Auschwitz. He heard that story. The next day at the Polish General Convention, he was talking with a Polish elder and mentioned that some of us had visited Auschwitz the previous day. Brother Carl didn't mention the story about the plaque, but the Polish elder volunteered to Carl, "You know, there was one time when 3 Bible student brethren escaped from Auschwitz." Wow. It was the escape of 3 of our brethren that triggered the self-sacrificing act of the Polish priest and led to the plaque that we had seen. Do we have love like that? Do we love like Jesus? Talking to his disciples that night, Jesus said in John 15:13, "Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." The Apostle John, in his first letter, writes a similar message but focuses it on those we identify as our brethren. 1 John 3:16-18. This is how we know what agape love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. If anyone has material possessions and sees his brother in need, but has no pity on him, how can the love of God be in him? Dear children, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. So it seems we should be willing to lay down our lives for our friends and our brethren. Is that as far as we are expected to go? If we would think of a continuum of people and relationships, beginning with our natural family members and continuing down to total strangers and even enemies, where on that continuum would we stop being willing to give our life to save the life of another person? Do you think such a continuum was any part of Jesus' thinking in making his decision to give his life as a sacrifice? Or did he die to save everyone on that continuum, including even the scribes and the Pharisees, his enemies? Here's what Paul wrote in Romans chapter 5, verses 6 to 8. You see, at just the right time when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. The point Paul was making is very powerful. Jesus' love went beyond being willing to die for a righteous or a good person, a person he knew to be right or good. He willingly died for those who were sinners, who were enemies of his Father. Would we do this for our enemies? Or for those who might slander us or mistreat us? Jesus said in Luke 17:33, whoever tries to keep his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life, whoever loses his life will preserve it. You know, the labels we create and use to identify and categorize various groups of people can create various levels of caring for them in our minds. They can include racial and ethnic labels, or they can include labels such as homeless people, people who have committed crimes or criminals, welfare recipients, gay people, LGBTQ people, politicians, Muslims, non-Bible student Christians, nominal Christians. The world has gone crazy with labeling and categorizing people. Each one of these labels invites us to dial down our love toward them. These labels dehumanize people and invite less caring for them. As I consider Jesus hanging on the cross, I cannot imagine that these kinds of labels for various categories of people was any part of his thinking. He was not dying just for some categories of people. He was not thinking that some categories deserved the value of his death more than others. He was dying to save them all. And so are we, as we follow after him as his disciples. That should be our attitude. Well, how might we demonstrate this loving others more than ourselves in practical terms, of valuing the lives of others more than our own life and interests? Well, it can be putting the interests of others ahead of our own, serving the needs of others at the expense of our own interests or plans, inconveniencing ourselves for the interests of others, comfortably allowing the preferences of others to formulate plans that affect me, remaining silent about my own preferences, showing love and acceptance toward those whose choices and lifestyles are in conflict with my own values, refusing to insist on the rightness of my view in the face of things I disagree with, allowing other expressed views to go unchallenged when no real or serious principle is involved and no adverse consequences would impact others. Having the attitude that no menial task is beneath us in serving others, especially if the task is distasteful, because someone needs to do it, why not me? And never considering the needs of others to be an imposition on our time. In conclusion, I want to read two scriptures and a couple of powerful quotes from notable persons that I find inspiring. Romans 13:8 says, "Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law." In Matthew 24, verses 10 through 13, "At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold, but he who stands firm to the end will be saved." I challenge us all, including myself, to be those who turn up the flame of love in these end times and not allow our love to grow cold. And here are the two quotes that I like. This first one is by a man, a philanthropist and a medical professional whose name is Paul Farmer. He died either earlier this year or last year. "The idea that some lives matter less is the root of all that is wrong with the world." We'll read that again. "The idea that some lives matter less is the root of all that is wrong with the world." And here's the last quote. This is from a Christian minister. He says, "Here's what I have learned as a pastor. You can't lead the people unless you love the people. You can't love the people unless you know the people. And you can't know the people unless you walk among the people." Brethren, that's what Jesus did. He walked among the people to know them and to love them so that he could die for them and eventually lead them back into a relationship with his Father. Let us make sure that we learn to love the people as we walk among the people whose recovery and restoration has motivated us to enter this pathway of service, sacrifice, and humility. May the Lord add his blessing.